Okay, and it's now 5 p.m. Pacific Time, July the 23rd, 2015, and this will be another call-in show for Radio Free Northwest. Now we wait for calls.
Until somebody calls, I'd like to talk about the Donald Trump phenomenon a little bit. I've been reading about him as well as watching a few videos of him giving speeches or being interviewed by various journalists or what passes for journalists. One of the more interesting reviews of him was by the Young Turks, by a guy named Sink, and his bottom line was that he's a buffoon, like you've been saying, and also he has no chance of being president, but that a lot of people liked him because he's a strong leader.
You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
Oh, this is Charles Martel.
The gentleman from the 269 area code, who am I speaking with?
This is Steve from Michigan.
Hey, okay, we've got you and Charles Martel on in our little conference call. Don was just talking about the Donald Trump phenomenon, but is there anything that either of you guys would like to talk about right away? Go ahead, Steve.
One of the things that you were questioning was about a response to the lack of publishing of your novels at this point. And when I saw that, one of my favorite heroes of the American Revolution was Benjamin Franklin. Part of the reason for that is because he was a printer and was actually quite instrumental in getting the knowledge of the Revolution out. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, he actually printed Thomas Paine's Common Sense for him. And if we had someone who was there in the homeland at this point that had a bent towards going into the printing trade, we could make good use of that kind of facility again.
Of course, we had a lot of things. You know, it's a case of if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. Just to talk about that topic generally, I'm sure I'll be talking about it more as the evening progresses with new callers. We do have a kind of a game plan lined up. It's going to take a long time. It's not going to happen overnight. Eventually, I hope to restore the Northwest novels to their previous situation where anyone can just basically go online and order it. Until then, it's going to have to be kind of proprietary. We will have to take over a lot of the distribution and whatnot ourselves. But arrangements are being made whereby you will be able to get both an electronic copy and an actual book to hold in your hand. It may not be quite as pretty as the previously printed copies, but this dry spell won't last for too long. However, I want to emphasize, and I'll be emphasizing again throughout the evening, you guys have until August the 14th to order any copies of the Northwest novel that you want, because the actual contract thing expires on August 14th. The letters to me were written and dated on July the 15th, and apparently there's a clause in the contract that they have to give 30 days notice, so basically they give them about 30 days notice. So the books will still be available up until August 14th.
Okay, that's great. I would really encourage any young man that would like to go into business for himself, that wouldn't be a bad way to go. And if he were interested in looking at how Ben Franklin did it, I'd recommend his autobiography. Mm-hmm. He talks about how he went into business and some of who his customers were and that kind of thing. It would help out the organization and give somebody a job.
In the old days, publishing was all self-publishing. Basically, a writer or someone who had something to say, someone like, say, Daniel Defoe, would write his book, and then, in essence, he would go into a partnership with a printer. And the printer would actually produce the books, sell the books, promote the books, and take his cut. Actual publishing, as we understand it, didn't begin until the early part of the 19th century. So, in essence, we're going to have to kind of go back to the old days in many ways. Until we can restore the status quo ante, we're going to have to take over a large part of the responsibility and the logistics of distributing the books and making the books available to the public ourselves.
True, but that's not necessarily all bad.
No. I'm frankly amazed it hasn't happened before. I suppose it was always in the cards. Charles, how's things going out there in the Wild East?
I have nothing to say.
Okay. Before we got off on that, Don was talking about Donald Trump, and since our two sort of selected topics for the evening are my book cancellations and the presidential politics of this insane epoch, perhaps Don wants to get back on Trump.
I was saying that the Young Turks reviewed him as a candidate, and the bottom line is they think his popularity is based on the fact that he's a strong leader or is perceived as a strong mm-hmm. leader. He will say something that people like to hear that's politically incorrect. He calls the press liars. He calls reporters liars to their faces during an interview, things like that. He's not shy. He's aggressive. He doesn't back down, that sort of thing. And he is talking about things that people are interested in. Of course, the big issue is illegal immigration. Another issue, of course, is America's fall from greatness, as he puts it, and the fact that the media are liars. So those are all interesting topics to talk about. He talks about them, and there are people who don't want to hear about that, and they're trying to suppress him. Mm-hmm. Glenn Beck has now banned mention of him from his show, so you won't hear anything about Trump on the Glenn Beck show. And others are doing the same thing. So the fact that Trump is way ahead in the polls right now is, according to the Young Turks, strictly due to the fact that he's perceived as a strong leader, and the other candidates are all mealy-mouthed.
I think that tactic of Beck's is going to backfire. His people are going to be perfectly well of Donald Trump because they're going to be watching other media. And the fact that Beck just stubbornly, like a spoiled child, refuses to mention the fact that this man is the front runner, probably will be the front runner for a while until they figure out some way to take him off. That's going to be very noticeable to Beck's little fan club. And I suspect that at some point, probably sooner rather than later, Beck is going to find some excuse to walk that back and rescind that policy. Because, look, if the man is leading in the Republican primary, it's going to be kind of fatuous not to mention him at all. Of course, now the Republicans have, is it either 14 or 16 candidates? Something like that. I think I could name maybe half of them. Some of these guys I've never heard of. Some of these guys like Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum announced, and then nobody's ever heard of them since. But of course, admittedly, that also could be the media. I think Trump, in a way, is on to a winning combination there because the three topics he is talking about, which is, number one, illegal immigration, as I said before, I think that is kind of the American issue in most people's minds. And the second thing is what he calls America's fall from grace, the clear loss of just everything we once had as recently as 20 years ago. And thirdly, the fact that nobody trusts and nobody likes the media. And I think there is a general awareness in the population these days that anybody that believes anything they see on TV is a damn fool. So I think he's got a winning combination there. All of this, by the way, is predicated on the idea that this process is being run with some semblance of honesty, the way it's supposed to be run, which, of course, you can never assume these days. I have no doubt that if Trump gets too close to the nomination, or it looks like he might cause serious problems for Jeb Bush, whom I happen to think is the official designated nominee, then something will be found to bring him to a stop. And I suppose in the last resort, it could always be the George Wallace solution. All of a sudden, a funny little man with a gun's going to step out of the crowd. I doubt he'll actually get to the nomination, but it's interesting that he's getting the reaction he did. Okay, we got another caller here. Hey, you're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
This is Richard from Florida.
Okay, very Richard, good. You're on with Charles Martel from the great state of Montana and Steve from Michigan. So how's things going down there in the great state of Florida?
Well, it's warm. Humidity's high. Looking ahead north pretty soon. I don't think the weather's as nice as what you have.
It's pretty nice today. West. The past few times we've been in here doing this show, it's been really warm and to the point of being uncomfortable. But right now, it's quite nice out. It's actually fairly cool. And this is, you know, July.
It's around 74
yeah,
or
right,
so.
Yeah.
So. Beautiful weather. A lot of it's distraction. They use distraction along with fear so nobody can get organized. That's my take on it. Trump is entertaining anyway. What Trump is saying, he's saying what a lot of people think, which the other politicians don't dare say. So he's a breath of fresh air, but maybe I'm suspicious by nature. No, maybe they decided that John McCain was getting totally ridiculous, and he's got so much baggage, so maybe they used Trump to throw him overboard to make themselves look better. And after all, Trump is in with that Jewish cabal, especially if he's doing business in New York. And I read somewhere his daughter is married to an Orthodox Jew. So we really don't know what's going on, but it's good entertainment.
In a way, it's the fault of the system because they've reduced the entire political process to a form of entertainment. They're ones who have dumbed down America to where any political content on the electronic media has to be about on the level of Dancing with the Stars in order to get through to anybody. And so, in a sense, in Donald Trump, they're reaping what they sowed.
Yes. Well, of the funny things that people have said about McCain is the fact that he crashed 5 U.S. airplanes, which makes him an enemy ace.
If you dig into this McCain thing, it's interesting reading. This guy is unbelievable, him and his father, and I think his father before him. Yeah, he crashed 5 planes. Interesting story about his wife, Henley. Her father was involved with the mobsters in Las Vegas, understand it, and as a reward for his good service, they gave him the biggest Budweiser contract in the state of Nevada. He's in with them all, and he was pardoned by Nixon. I said this on the radio one time. I said, they kind of cut me off quick. Yeah. I said, he's the only presidential candidate that's ever been pardoned for treason. I didn't believe me, but he was. Nixon pardoned him.
Now, Trump is the only presidential candidate so far who's had his own reality show. There's something just very American about that.
You know, the reason he's not continuing his contract with the reality show is to avoid the equal time requirement.
As they say, we live in interesting times.
That actually was a Chinese curse that one leveled against one's enemies. May you live in interesting times. Yeah. Charles, you want to jump in here? You're usually pretty talkative.
Yeah, I have to know quite a bit about the guy that threw Trump off his show. He's a total neocon shill. So getting kicked off his show is probably a good sign.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing is, we're talking about McCain. He's the guy that set the forest all on fire.
Yes, the wet start.
Killed about 150 sailors or something like that.
Ouch.
Back a few weeks ago, when we were having our little publicity spike due to that stupid kid in Charleston, I got a lot of media contacts, people wanting to do interviews with me, basically because they just couldn't find anybody in the movement who was even willing to talk about Dylann Roof at all. And I think I rather freaked them out because I wouldn't back away and flee screaming into the night at the mere mention of his name. But I got an offer to go on the Alan Combs show, and I didn't even bother to answer. I have no intention of doing that type of ambush TV, especially with an asshole like Alan Combs. Trump can get away with just plain calling him a liar. If I did it, I probably wouldn't even be broadcast, and I have no intention of playing their game. This is the first time this has happened in a while, but I'm kind of having to develop a set of protocols as to exactly what type of media I'll get involved with and what type I won't. The Guardian was one thing because they have a massive readership. They're international. And there's bound to be some spillover into some of the audience that we want. But what on earth would be the point on my going on Fox News? And contrary to popular belief, I'm fully aware that the Republicans and the neoconservatives are, if anything, worse enemies to us than the lefty libs. And I'm not going to have the Northwest message reduced to some kind of soundbite by these jokers. So I can fully sympathize with Trump's position on the media. And as I've said earlier, I think he's developed kind of a winning combination in that he's hitting 3 topics that really resonate with ordinary, normal people. The illegal immigration issue, which I'm convinced is the American issue in these times as far as just normal people's everyday concern goes. The loss of American greatness, the loss of American purpose, the loss of everything we used to have. And finally, the fact that the media is untrustworthy. They are no longer reporters or journalists. They're basically stenographers for the dictatorship. The trouble is, Trump is in a position where he can make those statements and they get reported. This is one of the things I've mentioned in the past. I think one of the problems we may have at some point in the future is when a great white savior does appear. Someone who, for whatever reason, can't be completely silenced by the media, and that reason will be that this individual will probably be some kind of political opportunist who comes from within the world of celebrity. He is within that charmed circle where the cameras are all pointed on him, and although eventually they can yank publicity, the fact is this person from the world of celebrity, his words will be reported, and this is what's happening with Trump right now. Trump has been basically their football that they've been able to kick around for a while. And I think it's finally dawning on the lefty libs that the more publicity they give him and the more they try to shout him down, the more he gets listened to. Don was mentioning that Glenn Beck has refused to cover his campaign any further, although I don't think that's going to hold. Another outfit that has decided they're going to not cover Trump is MSNBC, the big liberal media. I mean, like, anybody cares what the hell MSNBC says. Their ratings are just in the toilet, even below CNN's. I'm not a big Rush Limbaugh fan for various reasons, but he does have some good points. And he's pointed out that the actual listenership or viewership of these big, huge liberal news networks like CNN, MSNBC, the Alan Combs show, who's he's supposed to be Fox's token liberal, whatever, their viewership has just plummeted. Nobody wants to hear what these people have to say. They're just talking to themselves. And they're convinced that since they only hear the echo of their own voices, that everybody agrees with them and they're speaking for the majority. They're not. It's just the majority has tuned them out.
I think that's correct. I have no desire to listen to them. One, once you listen a little bit and you get the feel of where they're going with everything, it's just a waste of time. So I think you're right. I think that's where their listenership goes down the drain, because you may get a couple of newbies, people that are not up on things, and they listen to them. I remember Rush Limbaugh when he first came out. Boy, he was a real sensation. Everybody was talking about him.
Well, he was saying things that nobody had dared to say up until then.
That's right. I wanted to ask you about your publishing woes you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Your stuff's popular, and it was gaining popularity, I think.
Which is probably one of the reasons. My theory as to what happened there is that after that Guardian jackass described me as a right-wing science fiction writer, they realized that what was going to happen was that everybody was going to get curious, and they would go to the website, and they did. We got just thousands of hits off those articles in Politico.com and The Guardian and all the various spinoffs from that. And I think they realized that, my God, people are going to actually start buying his books, they're going to start reading them, and that's going to start giving this man money. It might have been an attempt at economic warfare, or economic discipline, as the left calls it. I think it's significant that they canceled all of my novels, all 15 of them, and of those, only 5 are overtly racial. I think that was kind of a preemptive strike to make sure that my novels did not gain popularity, and that's one of the reasons why we need to go ahead and get cracking and make sure that they remain available.
I think hurt you most was it the fact that the distribution of the books, or the fact that they're not printing them?
The main thing that I'm going to miss about that is not so much the direct sales or the royalties. I actually don't make that much on royalties, but they were a source of good printed copies of the Northwest novels that we ourselves can distribute. That's one thing. The second thing is, when you are hooked into that whole print per order network, you can actually order the books all over the place. Still, since August 14th hasn't come yet, if you actually go hunting for them, you'll find them all over the place, not just on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or from the publisher direct, but all of these little lesser online vendors, they're hooked in and they will pass on the orders. Now, there's one thing I want to mention right now while I'm thinking about it, and this is for everybody who's listening, including later callers or people who are listening once I upload this to RFN. Just because the cutoff date is August 14th does not mean that automatically every copy of the Northwest novels or any of my novels is simply going to vanish from the internet, because a lot of these little smaller outfits who specialize in mail order have actually ordered a certain amount of printed copies, maybe in batches of 10, something like that. So sometimes when I'm cruising around and I'm going to order one of my books, and I'm going to order from a minor source like Cool Books Incorporated in Poughkeepsie, New York, or something like that, I'll be looking at the sales screen there, and they'll say, only 3 left in stock. Order now. So apparently some of these smaller outfits are actually stocking copies. So it probably will be possible, if you look extensively, to order a copy or buy a copy of my novels after August 14th, but still eventually, of course, it's just going to dry up. Another problem that some people have mentioned is that they have ordered my books through this super-duper Kindle thing that Amazon has. Mm-hmm. I think you become a member and you can get basically free copies or 99 cents, something like that. But they keep the book on their so-called cloud. And it's possible that their Kindle copies may just vanish.
And your Kindle copy may vanish along with it. They have had a history of basically revising books in people's personal Kindles for political reasons.
That's one thing you can't do with a paper book. once you've got the copy, it's there. You can't bring up your electronic copy and all of a sudden it says something about gay marriage or some such BS.
I have a Kindle, and you're right. They can't have access to Kindle, but what I do with mine, I shut mine off. You can shut off the wireless section of it. Mm. Matter of fact, I do have one of your books on the Kindle.
The problem with that is whenever you load something new, you have to open it up.
Turn it on again.
What if you had a foreign publisher, let's say, that's not tied into the American propaganda?
That has been suggested. It's being researched and worked on right now. I don't want to get too much into exactly what we're doing because, once again, one result of all this recent publicity has been an increase in listenership to Radio Free Northwest, but it's also meant an increase in the number of outright hostile listeners of various kinds. And as I've said before, we're now being monitored by very hostile left-wing media outlets who want to use our words against us in order to do harm. And so I want to play the exact details of this kind of close to the vest, but I can tell you this, steps are being taken.
It might be an advantage because you could tie into their distributorship in other countries.
That's being looked into. I could, in theory, if I could scrape up a bunch of money, I could just find another print-per-order publisher, like Outskirts Press or something like that. I'm not going to try them for various reasons, but I could, in theory, just simply republish all my novels at some expense with another print-per-order publisher, which has the same distribution networks as the old ones did, and assuming I could scrape up the shekels in a fairly short time, we could be all back up and running. But then the problem would be, suppose it happens again. Suppose someone notices, oh, Covington's back, and this time he's with Super Duper Press out of Chicago or whatever. So whoever made that call to my original publishers would simply pick up his phone again. We need to assess exactly how we're going to do this. I actually do have a game plan I'm working on right now. In fact, I'm beginning the process of reproofing the Northwest novels. I started that today. I sent out A Mighty Fortress to have another proofread because I'd always figured if I ever got the proper combination of time and money, I wanted to go over these things again because everyone who's been reading them, sometimes they'll email me and say, hey, I've spotted some typos. The first three especially were hard because I was the only one who was doing those, and Mighty Fortress, for some reason, had a lot of typos in it, so I'd like to go ahead and get rid of those. But once I've got, say, an updated, properly proofread copy of all five of the Northwest novels, then I'll figure out what to do with them. There are some things shaking and moving already, but like I say, I don't want to get too much into it right now, in view of who's listening.
Who knows how it's going to play out? It looks bad now, but see what happens. The demand is there. You're filling a void. People more and more are leaning in the direction that we need separation between the races.
I think might be part of the reason that all of a sudden they just decided they were going to go ahead and try to lower the axe on me.
There's an interesting tie-in here with the book To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, the sequel has come out, and the sequel is 180 degrees on that issue. It's basically arguing against integration for segregation.
Yeah. I saw an article in the New York Times, and the crux of it was, oh, these poor little liberals who were raised on To Kill a Mockingbird as the ultimate piece of Southern literature, and they were so enthralled with this wonderful, noble, liberal lawyer, Atticus Finch, defending the poor nigger against the lynch mob and blah, 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 that they named their sons Atticus. And now, in 2015... this woman, Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, apparently is still alive. She's in some nursing home in Alabama. And somehow or other, either she approved or her kids, in order to make money, approved the release of the sequel to Kill a Mockingbird. It's called To Set a Watchman. And I've heard so much about it, I may even go ahead and break down and order a copy. In this new novel, To Set a Watchman, it's 30 years after the incident which took place in To Kill a Mockingbird, which I think was set around 1930. I've never read the book. I saw the movie once and barfed, and I've never messed with it again, but I'm familiar with its role. You know, To Kill a Mockingbird is definitely a part of the liberal iconography, and now the sequel has come out, and I'm not quite sure what the general plot is, but anyway, you know, there was a little girl, Scout, in the first book, and now she's grown up, and she's done the good, proper thing that all white Southern liberals should do. She's moved to New York, and gone to work for some liberal publishing house or some just living the whole liberal life, and she comes back to Alabama, and you meet Atticus again, Atticus Finch, the lawyer, only this time it's 30 years on, and he has kind of seen the results of what his liberalism has done for the South, or he can see it coming, and apparently he's turned into a real crusty old line segregationist. And he says nigger and every other darn thing. And so anyway, the lefty libs are freaking over this. They just can't wrap their minds around it because they wouldn't dare to believe that Harper Lee would write a sequel like this. Of course, I'm sure, given her background, it wasn't the intention to give aid and comfort to the enemy, so to speak. Well, now it's just you and me and Don, Richard. Last time we got about 10 or 11 callers, I think.
So let's see what happens. Yeah, see, again, it goes back to what we said before. There's a void out there, and it gets filled. People are interested. They see the failings in the liberal agenda and how it's affecting their lives, and Kill a Mockingbird is in the public mind, and sequel. I think they even have something on 60 Minutes about that woman, or some TV show. So they pique the public's interest.
By the way, some people think that she didn't even write the original book. They think that a friend of hers, Truman Capote, wrote the book, and it was published under her name.
Truman Capote was a faggot. He was also a troll. Have you ever seen any pictures of him? I saw an interview he did. Imagine a homosexual version of Leprechaun, the Leprechaun horror movies.
Yep.
Truman Capote was... I don't know anything about Harper Lee. Until the sequel came along, she was kind of like a one-book wonder, kind of like Holden Caulfield or Margaret Mitchell. So I don't know what her situation is, but I do know that the lefty libs are just doing their nut over this sequel because they're just so disappointed in how Atticus Finch turned out and all these little liberal boys that have been named Atticus down through the years. And oh, it's all so horrible. Liberals have this incredible ability to get upset about nothing. Of course, so do we.
Harold, let me ask you, you're a talented writer. The Kill the Mockingbird, I never read it. Is it really a good book? I mean, is it well written?
I don't know. I never read it myself. I tend to follow the old Russian proverb that you don't have to eat all of an egg to know that it's rotten. I know what's in it. I have no particular desire to sit down and read a whole book of the South being insulted yet again. It doesn't have anything to tell me. I did see the movie, so I'm familiar with the plot. I'm familiar with all the Southern stereotypes, and I'm familiar with the whole sickening bleh.
I did sit through part of the movie, and I didn't like it. I never finished it. I wonder, being all the publishers are either Jews, they're lined up with the Jews, everybody submits to the publishers, and then they cherry-pick whatever fits their agenda. And whether the writer is good and the writing is good or not, if it fits the agenda, they put it out there in the public mind to propagandize and fill the people's heads with this hogwash that's got us, I think you said one time, circling the drain.
Up until print per order came along around 1999, I tried for years to get legitimately published. And that's what a large part of the other 10 books that were banned were. They were books when I was actually trying to write proper fiction. And I kept running into the same problems. First off, by the time I came along, one of the steadfast and immutable rules was your manuscript never even got to an editor or a reader's desk until such time as you got agented. If you look in the writer's market, beginning about 1980 or so, most of the stipulations on the various publishing companies were no unagented material. So that was the first line of weeding out in defense. The agents were largely Jews or con men who are looking to get huge fees from would-be writers. I finally managed to get an agent. I'm going to make a very long story short here. I did finally manage to get an agent for a couple of years in the mid-1990s who liked my work to the point where he actually handled me without a huge fee. And he actually tried to get some of my early fiction published. And the Civil War murder mystery, Bonnie Blue Murder, he wrote me back and said he really loved it, but there was no point in my even trying to submit it because it had a Confederate hero. Now, this is in the mid-1990s, and I did get another agency. As a matter of fact, I think this was back the first time I was living in Seattle in 1994 or so, who agreed to look at my Stephen King knockoff, which was Revelation 9. And they sent it back to me, says, well, yes, we really like this, it's good, and I was, to some degree, writing for the market then, and so my villains were evil Southerners. And I have no problem writing about nasty-ass Southerners, because, you know, there are some, if that's appropriate. It's also the only novel I ever wrote with a female protagonist, and they sent it back to me and says, okay, we would be willing to try to market this, but we need you to make some changes to the ending. Amy, who was my female protagonist, is too much of a victim. She has to somehow or other come out strong or some such BS and the usual feminist rap. So I actually, and this is the only time I've ever done this, at that time I was just so anxious to be published. And I just said, hey, okay, fine, I'll be a whore. I'll do what they want. And so I rewrote the ending as, well, I won't get into the exact details, but I gave them as much as I possibly could without gagging. And I sent it back to them and it just wasn't good enough. One of my early manuscripts, Vindictus, which is set during the 17th century, and the hero is a cavalier, a former soldier of Charles I and II during the English Civil War, fought against Oliver Cromwell and the Roundheads, so forth and so on. And that got rejected by a female editor who said that my hero had a cavalier attitude towards women. And I don't think she realized what she was saying. Apparently, even my normal fiction isn't politically correct. Of course, this didn't surprise me, having been Jew-aware since the early 1970s, but it just goes to show, before this print per order came along, the kind of political and social and cultural Marxist litmus tests that were applied to literature. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with?
This is Terry in Florida. How you doing, Harold?
Terry, you're on with Richard, who is a fellow Florida denizen. And he tells us it's warm down there in Florida. Surprise, surprise. How you doing today?
Well, I'm doing very well, and he's exactly right. It is warm and wet, as per my last weather report, filled with misery.
Okay. What can we do for you today, Terry?
Well, I of course, don't know what the conversation has been about up to this point, but I wanted to introduce for conversation Donald Trump, who seems to have the mouth that everyone's listening to right now. Why is that? Why is he such a compelling figure to so many people? Because we know he's not compelling to the black population. He's not compelling to the Hispanic population.
Hi, is this Paul again?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now we've got Paul from West Virginia in here. And Paul, you're on with Richard and Terry, both of whom are from Florida. And Terry was talking about Donald Trump.
Where his appeal seems to be coming from. I think one thing that we can weed out of his appeal is that there is a large amount of racial resentment in the white population in the U.S. that we need to find some way to tap into. And I wanted to get your thoughts on if that is the case, that there is that large amount of racial resentment in the white population, and what more can we do to tap into it?
This is something I did say earlier, but unfortunately with the format of this program, there's going to be a fair amount of repetition, which is never totally a bad thing. I think that white people have been waiting for a long time for somebody to stand up and literally show his face and say the things that Trump is saying. Our white population being what it is and having been conditioned as it is, I've always figured that it's kind of necessary that such a public spokesman would have to come from within the world of celebrity, because this is where white people are used to getting their information and their entertainment from. It doesn't necessarily have to be a politician. It could be a movie star or a rock singer or a reality show star. And as you can see, we're getting kind of close to Donald Trump territory here. Trump is also uniquely qualified to participate in the process because he's independently wealthy. He does not have to depend quite so much on super-duper wealthy donors, although I suspect if he starts to show some chops in all this, he will get a lot of donated money. So this racial resentment you refer to out there is immense, and in a sense the white population has just been waiting for somebody to stand up and say it, and Trump, I think, has just enough ego and just enough misanthropy, or whatever you want to call it, so he doesn't care about what these media people say about him. Either that, or he's just basically tired of having these media assholes use him as a football to kick around. So it's going to be interesting. I don't think he'll actually get the nomination. As I said earlier, I believe that Jeb Bush is the anointed nominee. You guys from Florida, you probably going to be a lot more familiar with Jeb Bush than I would. Is he as wretched as he looks from a distance?
Oh, every bit of it. Every bit of it. One of the first things he did when he had the opportunity was to make sure that the Confederate flag at the Capitol Rotunda was taken down, and because it might perhaps, maybe, in some time, offend somebody. Jeb Bush is a progressive with all the baggage that comes along with that definition. I don't think that Jeb Bush would be very good for anything except doing the Jews' behest.
I'm tempted to say he couldn't possibly be worse than his brother, but I've already been proven wrong on that. I mean, we got that nigger in there, and he's worse than Bush. That's the one thing I do have to say for Barack Obama. He proved something that I never thought was possible. He actually is a worse president than George W. Bush. I think that what we're going to get in November of 2016 is going to be Hillary versus Jeb Bush. I feel reasonably comfortable in making that prediction right now. Unless there is some real seismic event between now and then. At Hillary's age, she might keel over of a heart attack, or her face might fall off or something like that. Right now, the Democrats are going batshit over this guy, Bernie Sanders. Oh, a socialist running for president. I think he's probably in there as a gimmick to try and force Hillary to paint herself into a left-wing corner and make commitments about how she's going to bring on the revolution and blah, 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 which is ridiculous. Right now, it's pretty obvious all she gives a damn about is money, plus her own weird little personal resentments. But I think there's a very powerful element in the Democratic Party that does not want Hillary Clinton to be president, largely because they're scared of what's going to happen to them if she gets it. I mean, imagine this aging hag with literally a lifetime of personal resentments built up over all the horrible way she's been treated by all these wicked, evil white men in her lives, not the least her own husband. That would be definitely fitting the definition of interesting times, as they say in the Chinese curse. And, of course, it would vindicate my novels, if anybody's allowed to read them. That may be one of the reasons they're pulling the novels off the market. They don't want my prophecies about Hillary and Chelsea to be known.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, you're not banned. That would violate the First Amendment. You're not banned, yeah. You're excluded.
I'm banned in the American sense. Again, it was not done by law, so far at least. They're not burning my books at the stake with the Inquisition chanting rosary beads or whatever like they did in Spain. I'm not in the gulag like Solzhenitsyn. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
This is Claudia in Connecticut.
Hey, Claudia. And Claudia, you're on with Terry and Richard from Florida and Paul from West Virginia.
Well, hello to everyone.
Paul, you've been fairly quiet since you came on. What can we do for you tonight? What would you like to talk about?
I just called to listen and to see if you needed any contributions. I don't vote myself, but I am interested nevertheless in things that happen in the government. I don't think we can let them feel that everyone takes everything for granted. However, I did learn today on the Internet, and I sent my representative and senator the letters. Representative from Pennsylvania named Tim Murphy, 8th District, has proposed a bill for mental health. This is the first thing in many years that would help American citizens, specifically white people mostly. And I therefore wrote both of my representatives to try to get them interested. They're not. One of the last one just gave his vote to allocations for $800 billion for war supplies, and there's not even a war declared. It hasn't been since 1941.
World War II, I believe, was our last declared war.
In December of 1941 was the last declared war. The rest of it's been United Nations.
United Nations are just, you know, the president deciding, hey, I'm going to go invade somebody. It's been pointed out that if you will exclude those two little ridiculous incidents in Panama and Grenada, which I do because I don't consider them to be proper wars, it's just like stepping on a cockroach. It's so unequal that you can really consider those proper wars. But if you exclude those two, America has lost four of our past five wars in the sense that we retired from the field of battle with the enemy armies and the enemy government still intact.
Clausewitz would consider those defeats if they're wars, but they really weren't wars. They never called them wars, so you can't say they were winning or defeating. Their police actions, I think they called them Vietnam. A problem I've had with people myself, I alienate veterans who have been there. I have a cousin in Bradenton who's a retired Navy man, that is Bridget in Washington, and he won't talk to me. I sent him a book about the Liberty and tried to approach these people. Mm-hmm. What's happening?
You say Bradenton. Do you mean Bradenton or Bremerton?
Bradenton.
Bremerton,
I get confused with Florida. It's Bremerton. It's in Washington. And you alienate these people. They have this devotion, this blind, this kind of chauvinism, right or wrong, you know, that is. And they don't want to learn things like this. They will just not talk with you anymore.
Yeah, we white nationalists experience that quite a bit, especially with our own families. It's something that Commander Rockwell pointed out in a number of his speeches. He says, if you don't like what I'm saying, just convince me I'm wrong. Don't just sit there and call me names and call me insane and abuse me and threaten me. Just show me that what I'm saying is incorrect, that it's not true, and I'll shut up. And no one ever took him up on it. No one's ever taken me up on it. And I don't think anybody's ever seriously taken any of us up on it. Because basically, the people that are attacking us and abusing us are perfectly well aware of the fact that we're right.
Yeah. That's why they depend on invectives. They come at us through insult instead of argument of facts.
So, Claudia, how's things out there in Connecticut?
Oh, pretty good. About the only good thing I can say is that we seem not to have chemtrails that bother people in the rest of the country. We have clear blue skies here. And I just wanted to throw out a wild idea. I'm a little bit familiar with internet marketing, and there's a website called ClickBank that sells ebooks, and some people claim to make fortunes off of ClickBank by promoting their ebooks. And I just wondered if that might be a venue for you to sell your book.
It might be. What you need to do is, first off, email me with that and all the links and everything. Is it where you actually can just promote a book? In other words, you do a promotion in order to send somebody to a link someplace else to buy it off Amazon or whatever? Or do they actually have copies or PDFs or whatever?
Oh, Harold, I can speak to that because I've bought books that way. What you get is an email advertisement frequently piggybacked onto something that you're subscribed to, but not necessarily. And there's typically a long advertisement with lots of background and reasons why you need this information. Normally, we charge $97, but you can have it for $19.95. And you just click there, and then you go to the checkout, and it's pretty straightforward after that.
Yeah, they do have the files there at ClickBank. You don't have to get Amazon involved or anything.
Actually, if it bypasses the normal so-called distribution channels and might be a little bit less susceptible to pressure, I'd probably want to take a look at it. Email me the details on that. As I was mentioning earlier to these guys, assuming I had a fair amount of money, I could probably find another print-per-order publisher. There's a lot of them out there who would go ahead and publish all the books, or at least maybe the five Northwest novels, and we could get back on the various distribution networks and whatnot and recover the position we had prior to August 14th. But if that were the case and we were to get back on the blogs and everything, hey, yay, yay, we're back. See, screw you. We're back now. People can still buy my books. Somebody would see that, especially now that we're being monitored a lot more closely than we were. And whoever made that call back in the middle of July would just go ahead and pick up the phone and make the same call again. So there's not really too much point in me going through all the problems and the hassles of getting any of the books republished for maybe $1,200, $1,300, and then just to have them cancel the contract again 2 months later because somebody made a call. If I had the money and I had a lawyer whom I was convinced would take it seriously and fight it as a First Amendment case, I actually might consider filing some kind of lawsuit in order basically to establish a legal principle that to refuse access to the means of communication and to the media of communication is in fact a denial of the First Amendment rights of the individual. And I'd also love to establish a precedent, which I think should be taken for granted, but when someone does this, when my books are pulled off and cut off from publication and removed from sale, the people that are doing it are not just violating my rights to say something. They are violating your rights to read it if you so choose. I would love to fight a legal case on those grounds, but number one, I'd have to have a hell of a lawyer who didn't particularly care about his or her career afterwards. And number two, I'd have to have more money than realistically we're going to get. Frankly, if we get enough money to fight a lawsuit like that, I'd rather use it for other purposes, more constructive purposes. But yes, send me the details on that and I'll look at it. I'm willing to look at pretty much anything. And one of the other guys suggested that we try foreign publication. I know that there are some foreign print per order publishers whose distribution network covers the same things that my previous publishers did. So one way or the other, we're going to work it out. Also, again, as I was mentioning, don't stop looking for copies after August 14th. People are just going to say, oh, well, it's August the 15th now. I can't order any Northwest novels. They're all gone now. And no, keep on looking because there are enough of them still floating around out there where if you shake a leg, you can probably get one.
Could I just go off topic a little bit here? This is something that puzzles me, and maybe you could enlighten me and the other listeners. What bothers me is about the movement, not your movement. Your movement is kind of straightforward. You got a plan. It's probably the only sensible game in town. But what does it matter with these other people that realize these other sites or authors or people that have different shows? Why don't you guys stand together? Not that one of the other sites has to capitulate to Northwest Front, but why can't they stand united and kind of watch out for one another and create a bigger movement?
I will answer that. I think I've mentioned this before on Radio Free Northwest. I will try to be as level-headed and rational about it as I can. But I'll tell you frankly, Richard, the story is this. In the last civil letter that the late Dr. William L. Pierce ever wrote to me, which was early 90s, before he started trying to do me in various ways, he said, the problem is, Harold, we are all chasing the same buck. And in essence, frankly, that's it. And down through the years, that buck has shrunk and shrunk until it's now almost infinitesimal. When I first came in, we actually had wealthy men who were backing various white causes. We just lost Richard. I'll continue with that. Now, white people as a whole, especially racially conscious white people, are so dirt poor. The competition for that donation dollar is really, really stringent. And the simple fact is that every time someone slips $10 or $20 into an envelope and sends it to me up here in Washington State for the Northwest Front, that's $10 or $20 that is not being sent to Stormfront or VNN or any other websites. I say websites because basically there are no organizations left in the movement. We're all internet now. The Northwest Front is the only group of people that actually has any bodies on the ground anywhere, as few as we have. I'm sorry to say this. It sounds cynical. It sounds depressing, and it is. But a large part of this, and a large part of the slander and the smears and the vilification and the internet goo-boo and that sort of stuff comes from the fact that we are the competition. It's not about Don Black or anybody hating Harold Covington's guts or any nonsense like that. I always got along quite well personally with Don Black. I helped him out during a little bit, at least, during the Dominica thing back in 1981, and as the Godfather would say, it's nothing personal, it's just business. And unfortunately, our business depends on money. Everything in the society depends on money. We have to have it. I am very embarrassed that I have recently had to go into a kind of a Jim Baker phase and start appealing for money more often and whatnot. We're doing things up here that just have to be paid for. Somebody has got to pay. Realistically speaking, there is no source of movement funding other than contributions, donations, if you will, from those who believe in the cause. I've had all kinds of suggestions. One of the most common suggestions that we always hear is, well, why can't we just start a business to finance a movement so you ain't asking for money all the time? That's been tried a couple of times, and what happens is you then get into the wonderful world of trying to be a small businessman in this economy and with this kind of government, and that's almost damned impossible. And eventually, the needs of the business simply overwhelm the cause. It's the classic case of when you're up to your ass in alligators, you forget that your original objective was to try and drain the swamp.
So you think it's just the money. I kind of focus on the moral issue here. Yeah, VNN is out trying to make a buck to support himself, and you are, and other entities also. But isn't the cause bigger than that? I would like to
put in a word here, because I think you're raising an important point. I see the movement a lot like the Protestant movement in the United States with lots of different sects, and they have doctrinal issues that they disagree on. For example, VNN is anti-Christian and anti-woman. And, of course, the Northwest Front welcomes both of those groups. And, like, the National Socialist Movement is you have to be National Socialist. And while the Northwest Front contains National Socialists, it contains other white nationalists as well. I think this is also a factor here. It's part of the American social background, and it shapes the white nationalist movement the same way it shaped the Protestant Christian movement.
I'm a National Socialist myself, and I have in the past, and occasionally still do, I've gotten emails from National Socialist comrades all around the country accusing me of betraying the Führer, betraying the cause. Harold, you know the truth. Why don't you still use the swastika? Because you know it is the way, the truth, and the life, and that sort of stuff. And I can't very well criticize these people too sharply because they're coming at me with stuff that I used to say during about the first 10 years of my career. So I get it. Yeah, there is some doctrinal stuff there. That's one of the reasons why I don't like talking about religion, because, as I've said before, it generates heat rather than light. But a lot of it also has to do with the fact that, like many, many white people these days, especially in the younger generation, we never quite grow up. I have referred to our way of life or our community, whatever you want to call it, as Movement Junior High. You go on the internet and you see some of this utter gibberish, not just directed against me, but against other people. You see everybody fighting their weird little internet feuds right now, and I swear to God, it looks exactly like a bunch of kids in junior high, especially girls. White people, especially younger white people, seem to exist in this kind of perpetual adolescence. And I sometimes refer to myself as the principal of Movement Junior High. And it enrages me. I'm probably not very good at it because I just have so little patience with it anymore. I've been hearing this shit for 40 years. I am really, really tired of it, and I admit I'm starting to probably alienate some people because I've gotten to the point where I tend to snap at them. Just basically, don't bother me with this crap. For God's sake. So that doesn't exactly mean, well, Harold, you're being so rude. You're mean. And I swear, it's almost on that level. So there's a lot of problems. The money problem and the competition for the same buck is definitely part of it. But yeah, Don's right. There is other stuff. I noticed this type of behavior when I first came into the movement in 1972. I have been searching for 40-some-odd years now, I'll be almost 43 years now, for a solution. I have a lot of theories as to why it happens, but as to what to do about it, I don't know. It seems to be just part of who we are. I will say this. I don't think it's so much a movement thing anymore. I used to think this type of behavior, this immaturity, this whole adolescent outlook, well, you said something mean about me, so I'm going to send out smears to all your supporters, that sort of crap. I used to think it was just a movement phenomenon, but when I was in Texas and I did my last corporate job of any length, I was working for a computer tech support company down there, and most of my fellow co-workers were young people in their early 20s, and many of them IT graduates from Texas A&M University. Many of them had master's degrees in IT. These were kind of the best and the brightest. And I noticed in those kids the same type of pathologies that I saw in the movement. So I no longer think that it's something that's totally restricted to the movement. It's just something in white people. We have been dumbed down. We have not been allowed to grow up. But there's something infectious about it. Look at some of this garbage on the internet and some of the things that have been done to me, said about me, some of the things that people have tried to do to me. And you have to realize that this is the work of men in their 40s and 50s, and in some cases their 60s, who are quite literally acting like 13-year-olds on Facebook. I don't know the solution, Richard. I wish to hell I did. We've got to figure out some way to just stop it.
This is why I'm confused, because of all the movements, if you go right back to basics, and I'm going to mention soul, but not a religious context, but I think the white people have lost their way. They don't know who they are or what they're here for. It's very simple why you're here. You're here to feed and breed. So this is why I like the Northwest Front, because you want to isolate the white people so they can feed and breed and embrace the next generation that isn't crippled by all this propaganda, subterfuge, mixing of races, being poisoned with every kind of cult and religion, so they grow up crippled. It took me, just in my own little world, when I got out of school, stepped out in the world, it took me 20 years. It took me 20 years to find out what the truth is and who I am. So that's why I say these other organizations, these guys have any brains at all, they got to see this. So what's wrong with Bill Pierce if you had a section of the country that was organized and white people would interact among themselves and the aristocrats would come back so that the 92 or 94% of us that are supportive adaptive, they're not leaders, they're supportive adaptive, they have somebody to follow. But it's gone. That's why we're lost, I think.
I myself am basing this whole plan of ours on the premise that what I call the alpha gene, the 5%er gene, is not completely bred out or lost among white people. It can't be, because if it is, we're doomed. I've mentioned this before. It's not that white males are incapable of being physically brave, of committing proactive, i.e. violent combative acts. It's not that they are incapable of displaying hardihood, self-discipline, dedication to a higher purpose, but they're part of the 95%. They have to follow the leader. They have to have a permission slip to be brave. There is a saying that war is when you allow the government to decide for you who the enemy is. Revolution is when you decide for yourself. We have got to learn to decide for ourselves who our enemies are, and then deal with our enemies in the old manner. It's a tall order. I know we have a lot of people listening to this, a lot of people in our ranks who believe that this is utterly impossible, that we're doomed, we're never going to recover what we had, never again become the men we were. I don't know what to tell you, Richard, except somehow or other, we've got to figure it out. Failure is not an option here.
Well, I don't think all is lost. It's just, how soon will it start? If you wait till there's the last 100 purebred Aryan souls on the continent, and I think if these people in control, if they get what they want, I think it's going to fail anyway.
Well, the Chinese are going to come in and take over, basically.
That's another specter, too.
Anyway, Claudia, you've been around the block a few times in this thing of ours. Do you have any input?
I think that one of the biggest fails, if you will, and you touched on it, but I want to elaborate on it, is that we never did what our enemies do. When they come here, the first thing they do is set up a little mom-and-pop store, and they patronize each other, they support each other, they buy from each other, and they grow and flourish, and they do their little neighborhood thing, and look what happens with Dearborn, Michigan. That's the result of that kind of thing. Why is it so hard for us to help each other in the most basic way? I mean, I remember the days when you used to talk about holy Aryan poverty, and there's nothing holy about
Actually,
it.
Actually, I'm still talking about it. I'm still living it.
I think I told you back, and I said, Harold, nobody wants to follow a, pardon the expression, loser. Everybody wants to follow the winner. And in this country, winning and prosperity are kind of intertwined. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go into business with one another? Why don't we help each other?
You're absolutely right. Americans have come to associate money with success. There's an American saying that life is a game and he who dies with the most toys wins.
Right.
The fact is, a lot of my holy Aryan poverty stuff has been basically making a virtue out of a necessity because we just can't seem to raise any money. I can tell you how we could do it. If some huge event were to get 10 million hits a week on northwestfront.org and everyone in the country were to become aware of what the Northwest Front is, the fact that we're here, the solution that we offer, there's no question that among those millions of new viewers, a lot of them would probably say, oh, that'll never happen, or, oh, that's too hard. But some of those viewers who saw the website and who absorbed the idea would be among the last remaining people with that alpha gene, that 5% gene. This thing could be done fairly easily. Realistically speaking, I could probably do it with about 1,000 people, but the trouble is, they've got to be Class A's.
Right.
They've got to be alpha gene carriers.
Let me just interject something. I was talking to another person like yourself in the movement, John DeNugent, the other day. And remember about 10 years ago you were thinking about starting your own religion? I know you were half joking, but you know what? I think that would have been a great idea.
If I were going to start over again in 1972, I'll be honest with you, just between you and me and the wiretaps and the FBI monitors, I probably would have gone that way, but it's too late now. I realize now, as I wish I'd realized then, that the spiritual and character issues are what's going to make us or break us. It is absolutely essential to address the issue of Aryan character. And if we could do that successfully, I think that would be something really, really major. Trouble is, I'm just a little bit too much of an old dog to teach new tricks now. And like I say, I've reinvented myself already a few times. And you can only do that trick so often before it gets a little old. The thing is, even a spiritual thing like a religion has to be connected with something to actually implement the program. Napoleon said that revolution is an idea that has found bayonets. We've got our idea. We just don't have our bayonets. I think right now, in the very limited time that we have left, the movement as a whole has to search out those bayonets somehow. Because there is never, ever going to be any change in this society brought about by simply tapping on a computer keyboard. It's no use to circulate ideas, and it's no use to leave comments on news articles, and it's no use to have these little circle jerks in which we write long articles on blogs and tell each other how brilliant we are when nobody's paying attention, and meanwhile out in the real world, Obama is suspending the Constitution and bringing in millions of illegal immigrants. Somehow or other, this idea we have has to be translated into the physical world, and that's the advantage of the Northwest idea, is that it could be so easily done.
There's people on your email contact list that I've traded emails with here in Connecticut, and we know that Connecticut is one of the tinier states in the United States, and we still haven't met. We're maybe 45 minutes away from each other.
I know that all this is sounding very depressing. All I can tell you guys is that we've got to drive on and we've got to beat it. And although it's probably kind of hard to tell from the way I've been moaning and bitching for the past half hour, but I am confident that we will. I don't maybe say this often enough, or I have difficulty conveying it, but I have a very deep and profound personal sense of optimism about this whole thing. I'm not religious, but I just find it a little bit difficult to believe that God or the creative power of the universe, whatever you want to call it like that, nature, however you want to put it, would allow the Aryan race to become extinct, specifically because we are basically the top dogs of creation, the top beings of creation. And I believe that we are the end result of a planned process of some kind on a cosmic level. And I just find it almost impossible to believe that we're just going to get overrun by a bunch of niggers because we're too lazy and basically we prefer the beer. And maybe that's just hopeless optimism, but I am really confident that something's going to come up. And Claudia, you were talking earlier about why whites don't work together. One thing I've noticed down through the years is that American white people don't have a racial identity as such, or didn't have up until fairly recently, because they consider themselves to be good old American boys, or maybe in a general way a Southern redneck, or a New York Italian, or Pole from Cleveland, or something like that. They have ethnic identities, but there has never been any really white racial consciousness as such in this country up until a couple of generations ago, because there was never any need for it. We were an overwhelming majority. We pretty much ran everything, or at least the Jews ran it for us, and we thought we ran everything. But the average white person would be born, live his life, and die without ever questioning any of these basic tenets and without ever thinking in racial or biopolitical terms. That no longer applies, because all of this yammering about Black Lives Matter and all the niggers running in and interrupting the rich people's brunch and the constant howling of insult and aggression. I think it's ironic that these lefty libs complain that whites commit microaggressions all the time. Whites are on the receiving end of a daily progression of microaggressions from niggers, from beaners and illegal immigrants, from Jews, from the system, from bureaucrats, from faggots, everything from the time we get up in the morning until the time we go to bed at night literally slaps us in the face and spits on us. That is creating a white racial identity, a consciousness of whiteness, if I can borrow a phrase from Salon. That didn't exist up until a couple of generations ago, but it's being forced on us now, and as we do become a minority on this continent, and we lose ever more every year of what we once had, that consciousness is going to increase. This is one of the reasons I think Donald Trump is going to go a lot farther than anybody gives him credit for, because either instinctively or because he just wants the limelight or whatever, he has discovered that when someone will stand up and articulate that consciousness and say what Americans want to hear, all of a sudden he's ahead in the polls in a 14-candidate race. So, at some point in time, it's possible that somebody else may come along who is a little bit less of an ass than Donald Trump, and who actually believes in the cause at least a bit, and who will decide he wants to be the white man's Martin Luther King, if you'll pardon the simile. There's all sorts of ways this thing could go.
I was going to say, a lady said, Claudia, she said that white people doing business among themselves. I think we're still competing amongst ourselves, while everybody else is war against us. As I said earlier one time, I think maybe finally, when our back's against the wall, maybe we'll look at our neighbor and say, hey, let's go get them. Let's stand up. I got your back or whatever.
Uh-huh. But what we need to have happen. We need to have it happen here in the Northwest. And when that happens, we need some kind of plan. We need some kind of consciousness. We need some kind of achievable objective. Just let's go get them ain't going to cut it.
Yeah, agreed. But unfortunately for us, there's still food in the refrigerator. There's a few bucks in the wallet. The car still runs, so people get by.
I have been hearing this for 40 years now. Oh, it's still too good. It's got to get worse. It's got to get worse. And okay, yeah, I understand that there's a good deal to that. But the fact is, it is getting worse. Who do you think were the victims of most of those home foreclosures beginning in 2008?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, everybody thinks it's going to be a one singular event when the shit hits the fan. It's not going to be a singular event. It's a slow process, like the frog being boiled in a pot of hot water. And it's happening right now. The shit is hitting the fan really slowly. So if everybody's waiting for a big catastrophic event, which may happen, don't wait. There must be 6 foreclosed homes in my neighborhood sitting there empty that I walk past every day.
Well, you know what Obama's going to do with them, according to his latest little housings are with the Federal Housing Authority. This has been on the agenda for a while, but he's now starting to implement it. Basically, the federal government, as part of their blockbusting efforts to bring so-called racial diversity and basically break up Republican voting districts, they're going to start buying up foreclosed homes and moving Section 8-style nigger and beaner tenants in order to break up, quote-unquote, racially segregated housing patterns. So that is going to be the next sign of racism, living in a single-family home. I don't know if you've heard about a law they've got in Britain right now. It's not actually a law as such, but it's a tax. If you have an empty bedroom or a room in your house that could be rented out and used for housing, largely for an immigrant, you have to pay an extra tax just for the privilege of keeping your home nigger free, and it's going to get worse. Of course, in Britain, the housing shortage is really becoming acute because you've got hundreds of thousands of non-white immigrants streaming into the island every year, and they're going to run out of space. But the plan here is to break up the suburbs. Also, they're kicking around the idea of breaking the states up into regional districts for tax purposes, meaning that, let's say you've got a basket case like Detroit, and they're going to create a whole big, huge district, quote-unquote, that encompasses most of southern Michigan, and they will all have to pay property taxes and local and state taxes into the kitty, rather than just, say, Detroit or whatever. The idea basically being to bring all those whites who have fled from the city back into the tax net and make them pay for those niggers. All of this is on the drawing board, and it's the process of happening right now. They are not going to allow what we would consider normalcy to survive. Eventually, one way or the other, probably, like say this being America, probably through economic pressure, they are going to try and force us into daily physical contact with non-whites. That's one of the reasons they like to go after the private automobile. The left has always hated the private automobile because it's what whites use to escape from diversity. Whites don't like riding public transportation in places like Chicago and Detroit and New York because it brings them right into personal, physical, hands-on contact with people with shit-colored skins. White people hate being physically around non-whites, and the left senses this, and they've decided they're going to make us literally be physically around them. Yep. The object is to, as they put it on Salon Magazine, to invade and break up white space. That's their latest buzzword. Whites must not have space. I mentioned this, I think, on the last call-in show. Some nigger college professor wrote an article about how the way to bring the wonderful day of equality, blah, 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 is that blacks must physically invade white space with their cameras, and they must videotape white people in their private conversations to put a stop to racist conversations, etc. Apparently, this guy is quite serious. He wants any gathering of white people, be it in a restaurant or in the break room at work or church or the playground or the pool hall or wherever, and now has to have a nigger monitor. This is Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with?
Got the trucker over here in Virginia.
Okay. All right. By the way, we got the trucker here. We've got about 8 more minutes. You say you're in Virginia. How's things out there in the Old Dominion?
Oh, dark. The sun gone down. We're almost to our delivery point out here.
Okay.
Yep, I just thought I'd go and call in, touch base, and sorry about hearing about the books being pulled and
well,
all that.
It was kind of always on the cards. It's just I kept waiting for that shoe to drop for so many years. I eventually just sort of put it in the back of my mind and figured, well, maybe I'll be lucky. But, look, I mean, I had a good run for 15 years, and I suppose it was inevitable. In a way, I think it's because they realized that, what with all this publicity, people actually might get interested in what I had to say and might start ordering the books. And as I've mentioned earlier during the show, somebody disappeared there. As I mentioned earlier during the show, we do have a plan moving forward to recover from this. Eventually, it will be possible for anybody to get a Northwest novel, either electronically or as a book to hold in the hand. I don't want to get into the details right here on this due to the nature of our audience, but don't worry, we're going to beat it eventually, and it may eventually, in the long run, turn out to be a good thing.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to go and order at least a couple more of them and stuff before they disappear on. Yeah,
before August 14th.
Right. Okie dokie. I haven't seen anybody doing that, ripping the Confederate flags off people's trucks yet, other than on the videos.
How's the general display going on out there in the South? Do you still see as many as you did?
Well, I just came through Pennsylvania and stuff, so
okay.
I wasn't actually in the South. I had picked up a load coming out of Seattle, delivering here in Front Royal, Virginia, up here. So we just popped in, went through corner of West Virginia there, and now in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big, big Confederate flag at the western end of Virginia on 81 as you go into Tennessee. On west, it's on the right-hand side. Huge one. I wonder if that's still there.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I remember seeing the big ones down there by the Speedway and stuff, but haven't been past there since this started.
Yeah, they're trying to ban it completely from NASCAR now. At some point, apparently a couple of years ago, they banned any of the cars bearing it on their hoods or the doors or anything like that, and now they're trying to ban the Confederate flag from NASCAR, which of course will cause their attendance to drop like a stone. And I think the president of NASCAR is quite well aware of this, so he's trying to fight it. I think if people like this NASCAR guy can just hold out for a while, eventually these lefty lib mobs of bloggers and rent-a-mob niggers will find something else to yell and scream about. They have actually pretty short attention spans.
Yeah, we're almost the customer and stuff, trying to get our way in here and stuff, so okie dokies. Seen a few flags out there, but not too many of them. Yeah, I gotta go, because we're pulling into the customer.
Okay. All right, well, thanks for calling in.
There's a surprising amount of rebel flags in Connecticut.
I see them out here in Washington.
They're apparently in Canada, too.
It's become a kind of a symbol of rebellion the world over. I've seen groups of Italian soccer fans at a match in Rome or someplace like that. They'll be waving Confederate flags. There's one team over there, Juventus, I think it's called. They had a Confederate flag phase at one time, I believe.
Some of the Russian flags, I believe the naval flag looks a lot like a Confederate battle flag.
I have relatives in England that I found on Facebook when we had our family tree down there. A whole gang of them still over in St. Helens area. And they dress up in cowboy garb, and the ladies dress up in like square dancing costumes. Mm-hmm. And they decorate their halls with a ton of rebel flags. And I couldn't believe it when they sent me pictures, and I was very tickled by that.
There are still some descendants, they're kind of mulatto-wise now, but there's still some descendants of some of the Confederates who fled in 1865 and ended up in Brazil. And they have little festivals down there in these little villages up on the Amazon or wherever, and they'll have some Confederate flags displayed, wearing some old uniforms and that sort of stuff.
That's really nifty.
Like I say, the trouble is most of them are half-breeds by now.
See, that's what we have to avoid.
Yeah.
I wonder how this flag thing is going to affect. They have Civil War reenactments. I've seen them up in Virginia. I wonder if they're going to be allowed anymore, or who's going to put them down.
And again, I don't think it will last too long. I think it'll run out of steam eventually, because these idiots are going to find something to yell and holler and scream about, especially as the presidential election draws near. But basically speaking, the niggers and the liberals of the world are never going to be satisfied until we spit on the graves of our ancestors. Yeah, that's what they want. Anyway, guys, we're about out of time now, so I do surely appreciate you calling in, and I should get this show uploaded about Saturday, Sunday sometime.
Yeah. Thanks, Harold. Great show.
Okay.
Thanks for calling, everybody.
Good night.